I'm so excited to be here this morning. I'm so excited and honored to be asked to offer a word of encouragement and just one person's point of view. I'll be sharing some work that's very exciting to me from my colleagues around the country. But I also wanted to particularly acknowledge our residents and our students and our staff, our administrators that are in the room, because you, in many ways, are the glue that holds it all together. You are manifestations of our hope and our future, but you also tirelessly are serving, and we look forward to the next generation of family physician educators who will help us actualize some of these great big dreams that Dr. Steiner has spoken about. And I'm particularly excited about his third dream, and that is to train caring and kind physicians. Certainly, one of my friends for many decades was a psychologist and an addictionologist. And one of the things that whenever we spoke on the phone, she'd always tell me, be gentle with yourself. And at first I thought, okay, that's nice. And then as our friendship developed over time and she became ill, what it helped me to realize is that being gentle with myself really allowed me and equipped me to be gentle with others, my colleagues, and also, frankly, with my patients, because it's a self-reinforcing cycle. So this is exciting to me. So my goal is actually just to speak very, very briefly to you about, so we have a common lexicon. I won't be telling you probably I'll be sharing with you very little that you don't already know. But consistent with the big dreams that Dr. Steiner has already sort of put forth and reinforced for us this morning, the vision for diversity and inclusion excellence is a big, audacious dream. And who better to lead the charge than family physician educators? Who better to step boldly into the future and to show the light of kindness into dark spaces that often our students and our colleagues and our patients have to move through in our society? So again, these are some of the big dreams from last year. Dr. Steiner's already spoken about these in addition to his new dream. I want to make sure that we because we're an educator, and at the end of this session, you'll be able to describe inclusion excellence. You will have some tools, and you, my friends, will have a plan. So just be clear that this is your personal PDSA cycle. So certainly, Peter Slavin, who is both the president and chief diversity officer at Mass General Hospital, really describes diversity as the full measure of the richness of human difference. And we look at that difference in lots of different ways. And those of you who like the visual of the iceberg, we realize that some of our diversity is visible to the eye, and some of it people make all kinds of assumptions about, and they're wrong. And then there are lots of things about who we are and how we identify ourselves and the meaning-making we make of those things that, frankly, people don't see. And unless they ask us, they have no opportunity to understand. So certainly I'm just gonna provide you with some snapshots and lenses. This is not going to be a data dump for you, but you know, we're evidence and we're information-based. I mean, what would a decent plenary talk be without some numbers? But I will apologize in advance because they're not complete, they're snapshots. So we're gonna look at diversity among students. We're going to look a snapshot at residents and GME. We're also going to look at faculty and just to have a brief snapshot on STFM and the diversity within our organization as it relates to race and ethnicity and gender. But I think we can't really meaningfully and responsibly talk about diversity, particularly in higher education, unless we acknowledge as a priori that everybody didn't have the same journey. And I don't know your journey and you don't know mine, but part of what we have to acknowledge is that as we embrace this bold goal of Dr. Steiner to increase the number of medical students that are interested in family medicine, we need to make sure that more of those people actually get into medical school, successfully complete higher education. And frankly, one of the things that drew me to Baylor College of Medicine was their 40-year commitment to K-12 programs. and that they did develop back in the 70s one of the first health magnet schools that actually served as a launching pad for many minority students from underrepresented groups actually to enter into medicine and the health professions. So just a quick look at sort of who's in medical school. This is total U.S. enrollment. This is both allopathic and osteopathic schools. As you can see, there are over 90,000 medical students that are enrolled in medical school, and over 51% of those happen to be white. If we look at those who are Asian, about 22%, and you can see sort of how it cascades from there. So certainly this was an interesting study, and this was all done on retrospective data, really looking at the proportionality of representation in the population using 2010 census data, comparing that to medical students who graduated in 2012, residents who were entering by race and gender into residency back in 2012, and then they also looked at physicians who were actively populating. And as you can see, if we look at representation in the population, we look at, frankly, who gets into medical school, who's in the GME pool, and who's practicing, you can see for women, there's over 50% of the medical school applicants and matriculants now are women, but if you look at the practicing physician population in GME, you can see some statistically significant differences. The only one of the areas where there was not a statistical difference is that there was not a statistical difference between the number of Hispanic or Latino or Spanish origin students graduating from medical school and those who entered GME. So as you can see, this is just a bar graph. It's an eye chart. I apologize. It's not for you to see the numbers, but I'm sure these slides will be made available to you if you have any interest. But I just wanted you to see that there is a couple things. There's some differences in race and ethnicity across disciplines, and family medicine is represented the second from your left. Again, you can see that there are a significant number of students who don't report. Unknown. And there are some dialogue, some language, some hypotheses that have been generated with regard to residents and students' unwillingness or reluctance to actually report. As we look at gender in academic medicine, again, this is data from the Association of American Medical Colleges. This looks at all faculty, all medical schools, allopathic and osteopathic. And we see that over 174,000 faculty. If we look at gender, it's about 60-40, male-female. And as we look at race and ethnicity, you can see the breakdown. I thought it'd be interesting for us to compare. So if we look at gender or sex in all physicians that actually are in academic medical centers and compare that to the gender breakdown among active practicing family physicians, what does it look like? It's pretty similar, it's still 60-40. So I thought it was also interesting to look at, so where do we stand with the residents? Have we started to move the dial at all? And certainly as we can look at all specialties, still only about 46% of residents are women. But if we look in family medicine, we've already begun to tip the balance at 54%. And I thought it'd be interesting to look at data from STFM just for your viewing pleasure, because as we think about being kind and caring, optimizing diversity, not only in our physician workforce, but also within our organizations, this might be an area of particular interest to you. And I wanted to also provide some information on gender or sex. We will have that debate later. I just wanted to at least make you aware that I'm cognizant and that I'm sometimes using sex and sometimes using gender. What do you want me to do? You don't want me to do anything. You just want me to back away. Okay. You're doing great. Okay. All right. Okay, with technical assistance, I can always do better, though. Are we good? All right. So one of the things, now we're gonna sort of shift gears a little bit. I've just given you some lenses or some snapshots, looking at our organizations, looking at our discipline, looking at academic medicine with regard to some of who's who, with regard to who's in the club. just wanted to shift now, really talk about the business case or the value of diversity and how we might begin to think about how we personally, in our personal PDSA cycles, want to begin to harvest some of this benefit. And certainly those of you who've heard Scott Page speak are very familiar with his work, and he really articulates the importance and the benefits of what he articulates as diversity bonuses. And he talks about those bonuses in a lot of different ways. But he specifically talks about, at this time in history, to solve complex problems, we really need diverse teams. And those teams are not just, he emphasizes the importance of cognitive diversity, where people come with different training, different mental models, and they bring to the table a way of solving problems so that it's complementary and not repetitive. So again, diversity alone is not enough, we know that, to harvest the innovation and the creativity, frankly, the complex problem solving and the prediction that we'll have improved outcomes, but we have to operationalize inclusion. So we've got to make sure that our diversity efforts are intricately connected with our systemic, our structural, as well as our individual embracing how we can operationalize inclusion excellence. And because the next generation of our work, frankly, is in this area of working within our organizations, both as models and as leaders, wherever we are, we're big leader, you know, small L leaders and large L leaders, but we very much have to embrace inclusion excellence and equity mindedness. It's important for our patients, but it's important for our faculty, it's important for our students, and it's important for our trainees, it's important for everybody we work for. It's not just about the other. Equity begins at home. It begins in my office, it begins with my team, it depends with the way in which I move within the world with regard to my role as a leader. And to the degree that there is not alignment between my walk and my talk, then frankly, I miss an opportunity to be authentic and to advocate for this big vision. So again, when we talk about what's inclusion, there are lots of people who've written lots of books, but this is one I particularly like. It's really about creating opportunities. It's about creating safe spaces. It's about creating organizations where everybody can flourish, not just some people based on which door you came in, how long you've been in, and what your gender or background is. It's really about connection. It's about creating organizations, initiatives within our departments, within our programs. It's within our institutions. And I really want this to be a call to action. It's not just so students have a role to play, our residents have a role to play, our staff have a role to play, as well as our faculty from a variety of disciplines. So again, what's inclusion excellence? One of the things that I'm pretty excited about is actually the work that's currently going on at the American Association of American Medical Colleges. And Dr. David Acosta, those of which you know David, who's also a family physician, is actually leading. And Dave has actually adapted and developed for academic medical centers an inclusion and excellence framework. He's taken the Netter 12 principles, those of you who may be familiar with that, that work was published back in 2000. He's really taken that 12 and he's really focused it down into 9. He's also developed a toolkit, and there are institutional pilots that are happening right now. I had the opportunity to be acquainted. We invited David to our school. He doesn't cost money. So those of you who want him to come, I encourage you to, you know, shoot him an email. He's a great speaker. He's really amazing. And those of you at Davis who know him can smile in your heart because you know that how amazing he is. But Baylor College of Medicine was honored to be selected to be one of the pilot institutions. And Dr. Toy Harris, who is our Associate Provost for Institutional Diversity, Inclusion, and Equity, is actually our institutional leader. So within this framework, and I'm gonna run through these 9, it's not gonna be exhaustive, but I wanna make sure that we all have sort of a common lens. So having diversity as a strategic imperative is really clear. It needs to be reflected at the highest levels of your institution, but also in your departments, in your programs, in whatever organizations and units that you are part of, within your clinic, if you're a medical director. But we have to make sure that our policies and processes, frankly, are reflective. that we also, if we say we're committed to diversity and it's a strategic imperative and we know how important it is for workforce diversity, is our staff, our faculty, and based on where you are and what you have, you may have a more diverse student body or a more diverse group of house staff in your program within your organization than your family, but that's no excuse. I'm gonna get to that a little bit later. So certainly intersectionality and authenticity. It's really important that we develop a holistic approach, and those slides are doing something special, so that's good. I hope nobody will have a migraine or a seizure with that strobing. But again, doctors are in the room. I think it's really important for us to embrace not only all of who we are and be able to show up authentically to our organizations, but for us to create spaces for all of our colleagues, our residents, and our students to feel safe being all of who they are. They don't have to choose between being a woman and African American or a guy and gay, that they can be all of who they are, and all of who they are is actually welcomed within our organization. That we really are intentional about cultivating a sense of belonging, that we really look very deeply at how we run our Society of Teachers of Family Medicine, and are we really embracing and creating spaces for people to belong and to contribute, for their voices to be heard. Certainly, as we look at how to optimize talent and leverage difference, you know, there's some of us who, there was a season of time, many of you are younger than me, because now you know when I graduated from undergrad and when I finished medical school, so I'm ancient. But one of the things that there was a time, and some of it still existed, when it was sort of the PC thing to say, I don't see color, I don't see race, I just treat everybody the same, isn't that good enough? And well, in order to really leverage the power of diversity and inclusion, it's not where we need to be. So we need to see it, we need to reflect on it, we need to engage it, and we need to leverage diversity. And certainly equity and equitable access are not the same as equal access. Some people, frankly, have had a longer road, a more complex road, and what we need, we may have differential abilities and our organizations need to make accommodations, so it's important for us to tune into that. I think effective communication goes without saying, except it needs to be said, because we wouldn't have to have a big dream to be caring and kind if we already had operationalized this fully across our organization. So I think we've just got some opportunity here. I don't know, how many of you, show of hands, have an ombuds or access to an ombudsman in your organization? Fantastic. I think this is really important, those of you who don't have access to one. I think it's another opportunity. Spirit of full disclosure, we have only had one at Baylor College of Medicine for 3 years. And I'm excited that I may have had the opportunity to play some small role in advocating for that position at our college. Because I don't know how many of you have trainees who are afraid to speak up because of retaliation. Or how many of you have young faculty who are afraid to speak up because they don't want their careers to be derailed. But an ombuds is a safe space, it's off the record, to get some confidential counseling, some coaching, and actually to better prepare our stakeholders to move forward. So certainly conscious inclusion embodies all the 9 principles, and it's basically how we walk and talk and move through the world. We create safe environments. We operationalize the imperative. And certainly community engagement, it's inside our house, it's outside our house with our community. And certainly shared responsibility and accountability, we're all accountable for inclusion. So if any of us are feeling as though there are aspects of our organization that could get better, I encourage you, I implore you, let's work together to figure out how to get that done. So again, there are lots of benefits to inclusion excellence, but now what? What can you do? So one of the things you can do is avail yourself of tools and strategies. And my purpose of this particular segment of the talk was actually to help those of you who are really busy, and that's everybody in the room, and those of you who may not do inclusion, excellence, and diversity as your day job, to make sure that you have some tools and resources that are free. Because some of your institutions may have embraced and are actively engaged in unconscious bias training. Dr. Steiner talked about the fact that the board here at STFM has already taken that on. But depending on how you go about getting that training, it can be a little pricey. But there's a free webinar offered by AAMC that I've got a reference for. I actually listened to it, and I think it's really darn good. And with your busy faculty, it's something that they can do at home, your trainees can do at home, but it's a way that you can systematically begin to use some of these things. So again, there are lots of tools and strategies. There's data. How many of you actually see the data for your institution as it relates to gender diversity and race and ethnicity? How many of you have that data in your hand? It is not, raise your hands high. Okay, it looks like maybe about a third to a quarter of the people in the room. So one of the things that if we're going to be data informed and data inspired, we need to have access to our data. And in order to operationalize the imperative of diversity and inclusion excellence, we kind of need to know what our baseline is. How many of you have incorporated holistic advising or holistic admissions either in your medical school or your GME program? Okay, how many of you know what it is? Okay, so again, I'm gonna talk a little bit about that. I'm just gonna point you to resources. AAMC has been at this for almost a couple decades. There are lots of free resources on their website. It basically is an intentional, explicit alignment between your institutional mission, your strategy, your objectives, and your goals. It allows you to look at it, encourages all of us in our faculty, training, recruitment to really look more broadly. So there is work happening around the country in both graduate medical education, which is relatively new, and also in faculty recruitment using a holistic process. And so if you have interest, happy to talk more about that if there are questions. There are also lots of strategies and resources here for recruiting, and we've got lots of strategies here for inclusion excellence. So how many of you have policies at your institution that really deal with mistreatment and racism? I only see a few hands. So I think one strategy you might want to consider based on your institution and your interest is to review the strategies and policies and procedures you have in place and whether you want to do more. Because one of the strategies, and many of you are familiar with Dr. Murray Garcia's work, and she really talks about the importance of silence and the penetrating impact of when things are said and when things are done in the clinical setting, and faculty are not trained and prepared to come to the aid of our trainees and our students. How many of you have had unconscious bias training at your institution and you've participated? That's great. How many of you have regular sessions with your trainees and your students about microaggressions and mistreatment? Okay. So there are some of you in the room that already have experience that you can potentially share with your colleagues at your table, and because you're going to have some homework here in a minute. So certainly, I think it's important for us to remember that not only our students and our residents, but also our faculty colleagues also experienced microaggressions and mistreatment, and there are ways that we can create those safe spaces. This was an interesting article by a colleague who was at an important point in his life, and he had just driven up to a fancy hotel for a dinner to celebrate the completion of his PhD, and a gentleman jumped out of his car and handed him his keys because he thought he was the valet. And it didn't happen but once, but twice. So many of you may be familiar with the work of Paulo Freire, and I just love it because his work in many ways, one of his books was actually The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And he taught Brazilian workers actually to read. And he said, sometimes things that are simple and insignificant can have powerful impact on our students. So I think it's really important. Tina Kenyon may be in the room, and she and Andrea were part of the initial conversations I had to actually have the opportunity to be with you here. And one of the things Tina brought to my remembrance is that there's sometimes when a faculty haven't necessarily, they're not diverse faculty to actually support your your trainees and your students from underrepresented backgrounds. And sometimes that feels limiting. And so I wanted to make sure that you were aware that these are resources that are available on MedEd Portal. They're free. If you haven't seen them, I recommend them to you. There are lots of educational tools and strategies, both for us to support junior faculty in their academic promotion, but also to help us mentoring. There are also a lot of academic and tools related to helping us optimize our work and learning environment. How many of you use OOPS and OUCH, the OOPS OUCH method? Anybody heard of it? Okay. So I know it's in some use. Again, this was a tool. There are things written about it. There are faculty guides. And simply stated, when something is said that is offensive or hurtful, if it's part of how things are done, the person who has experienced the offense can say, oops, okay? Or, you know, you can use verbals, nonverbals, depending on what works for the individual. And then the individual who perhaps unknowingly has said something that was offensive to a colleague or to a student, the person offended says, ouch. And the person who was speaking or may have unknowingly committed the offense says, oops. And depending on the level of training in the organization, it really creates a safe space, time permitting, and if setting is appropriate, for there actually to be a respectful dialogue across difference. And one of the challenges we have in our organizations is there's a lot of things that are hard to talk about. And one of them, frankly, is race. We feel very uncomfortable talking about race. And there's good reasons why. We're a polarized society. All of us haven't had lots of recent experience with civil dialogue or civil engagement across areas of difference. And I think this is a big piece of us creating the safe spaces and embracing becoming more caring and kind and teaching that and modeling that. Because if we can do that, if we can create those kinds of spaces that are safe for our learners, that everybody feels included, it's not just for the brown people, it's not just for the immigrants, it's not just for folks from a different country, but everybody feels like they have an authentic space at the table, I think that's when we can begin to do some extraordinary work within our organizations, for our students, and frankly, within our communities. I think it's extraordinarily, it's real. You know, there was a time when people felt like it was not a good thing to acknowledge that we have biases. We all have them. You know, we all have them, and unless we can begin to talk about just how we see things, how we understand things, that we can create relationships, trusting relationships across areas of difference, then we can begin to really tackle this work. And I do believe if we can begin to do this with each other, with ourselves, and with our organizations, we can do a better job for our patients with regard to not just encouraging students to come into family medicine and beginning to model the way with regard to what it's like to provide beyond the front line of care, to provide outstanding primary care, to interface and provide that continuity over time, we can begin to elevate the role, the responsibility, and frankly, the opportunity in family medicine for physicians and for students who are in the pipeline. So certainly, becoming equity-minded is an important to become inclusion, and equity really are also inextricably linked. And I think we need to proactively educate ourselves. Dr. Steiner spoke briefly about even though training physicians is important, that our organizations have some structural issues and challenges, and there's some things in the United States. How many of you are students of history, would describe yourselves as a student of history? Okay. How many of you have studied Reconstruction? How many of you would rather not talk about slavery and you just want people to get over it? Don't raise your hand. The point is, there's some historic exclusion that's gone on for decades. And this is not a one-upsmanship because I'm not trying to compete with Native peoples for abuse, okay? I'm not. So the goal is not one-upsmanship with regard to, you don't know how bad it's been for me. But I think to the degree that we can have open ears and open hearts and open minds to better understand what it's like for somebody else. I have the opportunity, I have a very diverse team, all five of us. And one of the things that I so appreciate about my team, one of the young women, she's a Texan. Well, let's put it this way. She volunteers in the rodeo. Anybody know about the rodeo? Anybody know about that? Did you know they even still have those? Well, the Houston Rodeo and Livestock extravaganza, it was something I didn't understand. It was something I had seen on TV. It actually raises millions of dollars for scholarships. And it actually allows a lot of young kids and future farmers of America to actually raise an animal and like sell it and then have enough money to actually go to college for 4 years. So there are lots of things with regard to cultural difference, and it relates to geography too, right here in the US of A, except I'm in Toronto, Canada, and I do know that. But you know what I mean. I think it's really important that we, for me, I acknowledge my biases. So I'm fortunate because I learned from my colleague who actually grew up in Illinois but is a Texan and is very much engaged in fundraising for young people to go to college. I have the opportunity to learn from a fourth generation Mexican American, and her family actually lived in Texas when it was Mexico. And I also have the opportunity to work with a young woman who grew up in Taiwan and immigrated to the United States in her teens, and English is not her first language. And so every day I get the opportunity to listen and to learn and to grow as I bring my curiosity and my humility to work. And I just want to encourage all of you that as we become more equity-minded, that I continue to be humbled by all that I don't know and appreciate, not only about those areas of similarity that we have that I didn't appreciate, but also my ability to appreciate the journey that someone else has, even in my administrative setting. And I realize that it's my job, and one of the reasons why I am still on the journey, one of the reasons why I took a leadership role, and I've been at Medicine for about over 40 years. Yeah, over four decades. It's such a big number. My oldest child is in his 40s. It's tough. Because when I see his gray hair, it only reminds me of how truly seasoned I am. But I think it's important for me to do all I can while I can to operationalize equity in my organization. For me to speak truth to power and show light. I frankly have the privilege of working with a president he happens to be Jewish, whose mother was the first African-American Studies first African-American Studies department chair and one of the scholars in Black Film Studies. His name happens to be Paul Klotman. His mother was Phyllis. You should Google her now. She was really something. And one of the things that we talk about, and I say to him, there's some things you need to do as our institutional leader with regard to diversity and inclusion. There's some things that I need you to say to the faculty, or there's some things that we need to do because my role is chief academic officer, but his job is president. All the department chairs report to him. So it's because of his leadership that we show data in our academic council meeting that's populated by our department chairs. We show them the data related to mistreatment of students. We don't have good data yet as it relates to mistreatment and abuse of our trainees, but we will soon. We've also begun to develop reports that actually look at, for our departments, not only the race and ethnicity of the faculty, but the academic rank. One of the areas that we, like many other institutions, have to work on is that although we're fortunate, we have over 60% of our faculty are women, they are stuck, just like women are across the country, they are stuck into assistant professor and instructor roles. And it's our responsibility, it's my responsibility to do something about it. I think it's really important. We didn't have an Office of Institutional Diversity and Inclusion before 2015. We didn't have one. Well, we do now. And I'm so honored that, frankly, we were fortunate enough to get one of the Center of Excellence grants from HRSA for health professions equity. So we've got a tireless small band of people who work really hard to do really bold and amazing work, just like you do at your organization. There's nothing special about our organization. I only share what we're doing because I want you to know that I'm engaged in the fight just like you are, that we're all on the journey to really focus on inclusion excellence, and it means something. We really want to begin to deconstruct and look at our organization, those policies and processes that are supposed to be race neutral, but frankly, they're not enough. Because if everybody doesn't start at the same place, it's not enough to help everybody be successful. So we really have to be committed to systemic transformation. Those of you who are not in positions of institutional leadership have an extraordinarily important role to play because you have the ear of people who have the influence in your organization. You, frankly, can provide the catalyst, the encouragement, the data, the support to your busy department chair or your busy program director. And you can say, I've got some data here. This is something really cool that they're doing at this other competitive school. Wouldn't we want to do this too? So it does take a little time, but these are labors of love. So right along with all the wonderful things we're doing for our patients, as we're thinking about our organizations and how we can be kind and caring, how could I just do one thing, just one thing in my organization that could actually help improve the experience of patients from diverse backgrounds, the experience of trainees from underrepresented backgrounds, that can actually help our women faculty feel empowered and engaged? Because how many, I'm not gonna ask you to raise your hands, but I'll just tell you a personal story. I thought when I was an assistant professor and I had three children and I was a residency director, and I thought, how in the world can I ever do everything I need to do in order to qualify for promotion? There were times when I really wanted to give up. But one of the things that really encouraged me was when I felt like my department didn't believe in me. My chair, the mentoring I received was, I just needed to have fire in my belly. I didn't even know what that was. But I decided that I would persevere. And that I would pull out all the stops, and just like when I was an undergrad and I wasn't sure if I would ever get through calculus, I decided it was important enough, the dream was important enough for me to go and become a physician, that I was gonna pull out all the stops, I was gonna give it 150%, and even if I came up short, I had done my best. So that's how I approached my transition to my promotion. But the good thing is, even though my department chair at that time couldn't help me, and I'm not trying to criticize him, I'm just being real. There were people at the institution who helped me along the way. So those of you who may not have all the help you need in your department, don't be discouraged, just keep looking. There are people, there may be professors right at this meeting, because I know Jeanette Southpaw's in the room, she's one, who frankly can help you, who are interested in your career. So don't be discouraged. When I got to, I kind of fell over the finish line with the promotion from assistant to associate professor. It was hard. I was atypical. You know, I was older when I got into academic medicine, and you know, I was outside the pale of what an academic looked like in family medicine at that time. So any of you who feel like you're like a little off the beaten path and your journey is a little bit atypical, don't get discouraged. Don't get discouraged. I'm a witness. I lived through it. I made it. But once I got to associate professor, and I had been there a long time, my then chair said, oh, when are you going to go up for promotion? And I said, I'm not. And he said, what do you mean you're not? I said, I'm not. I don't need it. Well, you know, what does it mean to me? And Jeff Borkin's probably in the room. And if he's not, I'm still talking about him. So what Jeff said to me is, it's not about you. It's about all the young women you mentor and you model for. You have to do it for them. So just like your patients who may have type 2 diabetes, who frankly are not so interested in their numbers, but you can talk to them, you can do some patient-centered counseling, and because you know that they care for their grandchildren and they really have a commitment to their faculty and what they won't do for themselves, they will do for others, that was the argument that was the tipping point for me. So in all of your institutions, you have women, and men too, who are stuck at associate professor. They're tired, they're busy, and they can't make the case for why they should invest the time to actually put together a promotion package, even when they're qualified. So I wanted to encourage you to invest time in mobilizing the folks who can do things right where you are, because being equity-minded is about looking at your peers and your colleagues and supporting them as well. And we have to recognize that our partnerships are not only within our organization, but frankly, in our community. So again, here's where you get the homework. Okay, this is where you're gonna need to talk amongst yourselves. Okay, there might not be anything useful that I have said to you, but perhaps it gave you a little time to think about something that's been bugging you, something that's going on at your institution that you think somebody should do something about. It's just not right. And I'm encouraging you this morning that you are that somebody. You are that person. So I want you, because you know now at all of our academic meetings, when you go to clinical meetings, they ask you, what are those two or three things or those one or two things that you're going to do differently based on this talk? So I'm not going to say that it's this talk that actually is the motivator for you to do one or two things differently, but perhaps it gave you time to think about something or reconnect with something that has been on your mind, something that is irritating to you, something you feel like needs to get fixed in your organization in the domain of inclusive excellence in any of these nine domains. And so now, how much time do we have?
About 18 minutes.
Okay, we have a whole 18 minutes, so I'm so excited that I got through that, because now I'm gonna give you five of those 18. And I want you to take out a piece of paper, take out your phone, take your notes. I realize you guys are all modern. You know, you're doing notes in your phone. You've got your iPads. Some of you even have your computers. Or maybe some of you even have pens and paper, not sure. You may be throwbacks like me. I encourage you to, this is a think, pair, share opportunity. So you will think, take about a minute or two, then share with a partner two or three around the table, and then share across your table the one or two things that you will do. Even if you commit to think about it, even if you commit to research it, I really want you to think about something that you can do, because we're not going to be able to move forward with the bold goals that Dr. Steiner's laid out, or frankly, to move toward our institutional excellence and have our organization operating and exemplifying all nine of these principles. So take 5 minutes and then talk amongst yourself. So can we come back together? So those of you who were able to share and willing to share, don't know if we have one or two people who got energized who might want to come to the mic and just share what you learned. If not, just be happy sitting right where you are. All right, so I thank you for engaging. I thank you for the dialogue around your table, and hopefully some of you have some things that you're ready to at least think about or continue to work on or begin to work on. So again, we've got to advance the vision together. We're gonna rethink what's possible. We're gonna get away from old mindsets that are constricting. We're gonna adopt those big, bold, audacious goals. We're going to embrace and value and leverage diversity where we are. We're going to do what we can, while we can, where we can. We'll commit to practice conscious inclusion and to really model many of those principles that our organizations ideally should take on to help to reduce and deal with some of the structural issues that are front of all of us. And now I think it's time for us to think about how we can go for it. Just like we're gonna, I wanna add this inclusion excellence as maybe the fourth big dream that we can work toward in our organizations and in our society. So thank you very much.